This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the president and CEO of SkyVector about flight planning. In the news, we look at transferring funding for light attack planes to the U.S. Special Operations Command, the Aircraft Noise Reduction Act, Boeing's Board of Directors' decision to pause 737 MAX production, and Alaska Airlines' ugly holiday sweater promotion. We also have the Australia News Desk from the Boys Down Under. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 583 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine and publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to everybody. Thank you for inviting me, Max.
It's good to have you here with us, Rob.
I'm older now than I used to be.
Well, you're older than you were the last time you were on the show.
Well, that's true. Yes. Good point.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert. Hey, David.
Hey, everyone. Looking forward to a good conversation where luckily we only have one Max tonight because we have two Davids.
That's right. The other Max, Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast, is off this week. As he told us last week, he's delivering a Cirrus aircraft to a eager, happy new customer. But we also have with us Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large, Launchpad Marzari.
Greetings from deep in the heart of, hey, how come we never have two launch pads on this show?
maybe we should hunt for, you think we could find another launch pad?
A large duck. Large pilot duck.
Yes, not likely, right? All right. Well, let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's David Graves. He's president and CEO of SkyVector. Now, many of you, I think, are familiar with SkyVector. They provide worldwide aeronautical charts, online mapping, related flight planning products and services. The company combines its aeronautical mapping capability with weather and data overlays, airport information, FBO listings, and more. Now, as for David, in 2003, he was working as a programmer for a Seattle startup, and he took an introductory flight with a small flight school at Boeing Field. Well, his first solo came after 4 months and 20 hours, and his private pilot license followed about a year later. Now, SkyVector went online in the fall of 2006, and it grew quickly. By the end of 2009, it was experiencing over 100,000 unique users a month. In 2010, David quit his job to work on SkyVector full-time. The World VFR and World IFR charts went live in 2012. Flight plan filing went live in 2015. And at the end of the decade, SkyVector is being visited by over 550,000 unique users per month. David, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that SkyVector would grow? You sent us some statistics just looking at yesterday, which for us is December 15th, which was a Sunday, and SkyVector served about 16.5 million map tiles, 2.5 million images of radar and satellite weather, and 125,000 computed flight plans. It kind of has taken off, hasn't it?
It always surprises me to see the reaction and the response. It's fun to meet users and learn and hear how they use the site. Some of them use it in very surprising ways. But yeah, we're very proud of our growth. And, you know, it's been a fun living for me in the last decade working for myself. But really, that means working for 500,000 pilots with lots of ideas of what the website should be like. So it's been a lot of fun.
I especially like the part about quitting your job to devote your full energy to something that's clearly a passion for you. I think that's really cool. A lot of people don't get to do that.
It was momentous for me. That's why I always mention it whenever I'm telling the story of SkyVector, because that's when I held my breath and jumped in, you know?
Excellent. All right, we'll jump into some of those details also coming up, but first we have some aviation news from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Sure.
Ready deep in the heart of.
Ready.
First item comes from Defense News. This is Congress may have given the Air Force an exit door for the light attack aircraft program. Oh, boy, David, you're going to have to explain this because I get that this is about the light attack aircraft program. But what is Congress doing here? What are they asking the Air Force to consider?
Well, simply put, the Air Force has not wanted to buy light attack aircraft. Now, light attack means an aircraft, something in the class of the Embraer Tucano or the AT-6. And it was designed, these are turboprop, two-seat, light attack aircraft that we could use for counterinsurgency or COIN. The counterinsurgency has been a bane of the United States Air Force's existence since its inception. The Army has for years wanted a light attack aircraft that they could call their own. However, the Air Force was sort of muscled into having to try to procure aircraft for these special operations light attack things. And we purchased a bunch of Tucanos for the Afghan Air Force. So these are trainers that can be used in an insurgency kind of basis where you don't want to deploy multi-million dollar aircraft like F-16s or F-35s or even A-10s. The Air Force has been slow walking the whole process because they really don't want them, but they keep being forced to have them. Well, the Congress has decided that maybe the Air Force shouldn't be running this program to develop this light attack aircraft, but maybe the special operations, Air Force Special Operations community should be running it, which is good because that way Special Ops has been able to purchase aircraft for their needs without a lot of scrutiny, and they are not in the fast jet business, but they'll be able to purchase these aircraft, and that gets the Air Force out of the U.S. Air Force out of the procurement of aircraft that they don't want. This is sort of parallel to the A-10. They want F-35s. They don't want anything that goes low, slow, and shoots things on the ground. But these aircraft are very important. You can go back in time. In Vietnam, the A-1 Sky Raider, which was a giant reciprocal engine aircraft that flew low and slow, took lots of hits, but was perfect for getting down and dirty and supporting the troops on the ground. Eventually that became the A-10. But in this case, that kind of aircraft is still in need, though the Air Force doesn't really want to buy them. So here we're having Special Operations Command look at purchasing them and setting up requirements for their organizations, and then we could send them to our military or other countries for support and training, et cetera, like we've done with the Embraers in Afghanistan. So it's keeping the program alive, but giving it, I think, a better opportunity by going to SOCOM.
Let me stick in here with my policy wonk for the defense, is that I'm not sure this is a good idea because let me be very clear. I'm all for the light attack program, but this way of doing it, SOCOM is a combatant command, not a service provider. The service providers are who you traditionally think of, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. And having a big program under a combatant command rather than a service provider could really start to stretch and cross over some demarcation lines of who's supposed to be doing what. Because combatant commands are supposed to reach back and program what they need from the service providers. They're not supposed to be out there funding their own long-term projects. So the policy wonk in me from my days in the five-sided world, kind of goes, oh, wait a minute, this may be blurring the lines a little.
Is there precedent for this kind of a thing?
Absolutely. SOCOM has purchased a lot of aircraft, a lot of them currently off the shelf, specifically for their needs without interference by the Air Force. So they've purchased Dornier 228s, as well as there's a lot of specific aircraft that they have purchased literally off the shelf for their needs, which is where this is falling from. They don't necessarily, since it's a combined joint command, meaning SOCOM reports to the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, and the Navy, they all filter into it. They have their own purchasing power, which I think, Brad, is where that's coming from, is they have their own purchasing power instead of just on top of the three service providers.
All right.
Yeah, but normally when they do that, though, they get the funding and they'll purchase it and then route the funding through one of their service providers. So it's like the Air Force gives it up and then the SOCOM could turn around and go, congratulations, here's a wad of money, go buy us light airplanes. And the Air Force going, dope, not what we wanted.
All right, let's push on. The next item, this comes from BroomfieldEnterprise.com. The U.S. congressman representing the 2nd District of Colorado has introduced some legislation. It would give local general aviation airports the power to set noise restrictions. As I understand it, currently airports have to get approval from the FAA if they want to establish things like curfews or other restrictions on flight operations that are designed to address noise. This would be something different. Rob, do you think, have you been following this? Do you think this is a good idea? This is the Aircraft Noise Reduction Act.
I have not been following it until I saw that pop up on the news. But I, what I can tell you is that having worked with a lot of airports over the years, you could replace the name of Rocky Mountain Airport with almost any other general aviation airport that has business aviation airplanes, meaning turbine-powered airplanes, and you could make the story stick because everybody pretty much has the same complaint that those jets start flying early in the morning and they go till late at night and they fly right over my house. So I don't really mind the airport, but make them go some other way.
Yeah.
While I know that the basic noise issues that they deal with under what we what's known to the feds as the Part 150 program is excruciatingly long, slow, what have you, and often doesn't really do much of anything, allowing the airports themselves to run this, it's a possibility. I mean, I guess what many operators might be concerned about is that not just what the restrictions are airports might produce on their own, but how they would implement them. Because traditionally, these small airports, I'm not even talking super small, Rocky Mountain's not a tiny little place. I was just in there a couple of weeks ago, actually. They're often managed by an airport manager and an airport board of directors who are typically, not always, but are typically members of the community who have volunteered to the local governance group, the mayor or whatever, saying, hey, if you need any help sometime on some organization, let me know. I'd be happy to help. And they choose them basically on that. They often have no aviation experience at all. So whoever is kind of the smartest and tends to lead them can often, you know, win the day. And so I think the operators might be a little concerned about that. But this is a good story, and I do want to follow up on it. I don't know who put it in. I just unfortunately got my news tonight a little bit late.
Yeah, that's my fault. I'll follow my sorry.
I wasn't going to add an accountability track into this. No, yeah. But it's an interesting story. It really is. And obviously, if this works and this passes, this is going to set some standards that are going to be very eye-opening.
Hmm.
I'm very scared about it because while I do think that communities have sovereignty and the right to control themselves, I see the possibility for a Santa Monica end run where, oh, no, we're not going to restrict your runways. Oh, no, we're not going to shorten your runways. But we are only going to allow flight operations from 12 to 12:30 Monday through Friday, and noise abatement will be effective the rest of the time.
It's a good point. It is.
I'm very scared of that. And the very last paragraph of this document talks about airports enacting noise abatement procedures, such as adopting voluntary curfews and educating flight school operators. Uh-oh, now we're talking about when we can go out and do pattern work. Mm-hmm. And that suddenly is talking about, you know, little propeller airplanes doing touch and goes. And I think there might be a slippery slope here. And
I think you're right. I really do. And that's why I said before it may not be the noise restriction issue. It may be how they implement it. And again, right now it looks like it's kind of wide open. So I think we're going to have to keep an eye on this.
But there also comes in the second part is when you start talking urban, air urban mobility.
Yeah.
Is the cities want to legislate that. So there may be some, again, demarcation where the FAA is controlling, you know, class A, B, or C, D, and B airspace, but everything below 400 feet, the cities get to do because that's where the urban mobilities are going to run. Hmm. Who knows? I'm just throwing that out there as a thought.
Yeah, that's a good possibility.
David, how about the airport where you fly out of, your local airport? Do you run across noise complaints, noise problems from the community?
We've had a fly quiet program at Boeing Field for years now. It gets updated every so often in response to the community. We are right under SeaTac's Class Bravo. In fact, one of the Bravo shelves is 800 feet above the airport.
Hmm.
So there's a tight turn on a certain pattern that's always fun to make. As a result, I think Boeing Field, its noise is largely overshadowed by SeaTac. So a lot of the noise complaints, even if perhaps were generated by a bizjet landing at BFI, I think get complained to and assigned to SeaTac as a noise complaint. So I'm not sure, you know. Our situation is a little bit unique here, but Seattle is a growing area, and our airport is growing very fast. And there's a lot of concern about that in the area.
Yeah, sure. All right.
Yeah, and one other thing that we have to keep in mind when we talk about local airports legislating is that, as I said before, a lot of the people kind of running these airports may be well intentioned, but they often have very little experience on the operational side of aviation. And so we don't want to see some airport institute something that is not safe or that could be questionable. But again, you know, is there a happy medium? Oh, of course there always is. We just don't seem to ever be able to get there though.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, we'll be following this story for sure. And again, it's been introduced in the House, this bill, and that could have a long and torturous path, or it could go nowhere quickly. We just don't know at this point, but we'll be watching for sure.
Well, what else in the news could possibly overshadow this?
The 737 MAX, because it's another week, another
another MAX.
That's right. And this is actually breaking news as we record this. The Boeing Board of Directors had a previously scheduled board meeting, and today, as we record this, which is, the 16th, December 16th, the Boeing Board of Directors decided to pause 737 MAX commercial production in January 2020. Production of the P-8 military version of the 737 continues. This is just the commercial side of it. But this has been kind of the open question. As we know, Boeing manages their production by holding a certain production rate, and they do this for, as far as I know, all of their aircraft models. So many aircraft per month, and the 737 MAX had been running at 52 aircraft per month, and they knocked that down to 42 per month. The question has been, as this thing goes on and on and on and on, and the aircraft pile up and pile up and pile up, there's something like 375 undelivered aircraft sitting around, 737 MAX. So the question has been, how long can they keep producing airplanes? And it looks like the board of directors has made their decision, and in January, they are just going to stop.
I don't think this is any great surprise to most people. In fact, I at least expected it prior to this, because you realize that almost 400 airplanes times whatever the cost is to Boeing per airplane, that's all money that is coming out of Boeing's pocket that they're not being reimbursed for by people who want to buy the airplanes, or at least wanted to buy the airplanes. And so that means they're eating that, in addition to all the monthly fees for storing these airplanes. And that doesn't even begin to look at the reparations that Boeing is going to need to make to the airlines that operate the, I forgot how many now, it's been so long, I've forgotten how many MAX airplanes were in service last March when the fleet was grounded. So there's a lot of 737 MAXs and parts and supplies and everything else sitting on the ground going nowhere, and the news just never seems to get any better for Boeing.
It's a remarkable thing. I remember when the aircraft were first grounded all those months ago, my prediction on record was 12 months from now, this will all be forgotten. Everything will be back to normal. Boy, was I wrong on that. Was I wrong on that one for sure? But the cost is huge. It's reported that Southwest Airlines reached a compensation agreement with Boeing. They had projected an $830 million hit to operating income in 2019 as a result of the grounding. So Southwest and Boeing have come to some kind of an agreement, which is confidential, details haven't been released. But that's, now Southwest, of course, is the largest 737 MAX customer, so that's a big one. But there are a lot of others out there that are, if they're not already, are going to be seeking compensation. But stopping or pausing production, Boeing says they're not going to lay off workers. They're going to redeploy them. That'll be interesting to see where all of those hundreds and thousands of workers go. But there's also the ripple effect into the supply chain. There are a lot of other companies that will be affected pretty strongly as a result of this.
Oh, I absolutely agree. In fact, I think that is, I don't want to say it's a bigger deal, but it is as big a deal as the money that Boeing is losing. I mean, look at the people that all these smaller companies that make all the parts that come together for the MAX. And now they're saying, guys, don't send us any more stuff. Well, what are we supposed to do with it all? We'll get back to you on that. So that means all those small companies are going to take a hit. And depending upon how long they need to sit around with all these extra inventory, they may indeed start looking elsewhere to peddle these parts or perhaps reuse them in some other way. And again, getting a line. In fact, I remember reading a book about Ford years ago, and they said it was stopping the line was right up there in line with the end of the world for them, because not just because of the stoppage, but how difficult it was to get it rolling again. And so that's another issue that Boeing is going to have to deal with. But again, so the bad news just keeps coming.
It really does.
I think the other thing that's downstream is, my first thought was Wichita, because Spirit Airline, that makes the body, is going to have to slow down because I don't know how many P8s they're making a month.
You mean Spirit Aerostructures?
Spirit Aerostructures, excuse me. Yeah. But Wichita just got news that, you know, Bell or Textron is laying off, what, 350 in town? And now Spirit's going to be slowing down and maybe furloughing. I don't know if laying off's the right word, but, you know, oh, golly. Think of that. You know, there's another happy community that's like going, you know, holding, sucking air between their teeth.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm having trouble believing that Boeing is just going to be able to absorb all of these employees getting them to do something else. Maybe, but I'm having some trouble with that one.
Yeah.
I disagree. I think for maybe probably a month to 2 months, it will not be hard to have these guys work at other things. You know, if nothing else, just taking the time to help, you know, keep them there under your chart. Because once you release them, bringing back, you know, trying to restart the line and everybody's gone out and found new jobs, ooh, that gets real difficult.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
But you got to find other positions for which they're qualified or for which they're certified in some cases. You know, unless you're going to have the crew outside painting the outside of the building, you know, if you're going to have them doing production work, you know, I don't know how interchangeable, you know, some of these employees are. Like I say, for many of the positions, you have to be trained to perform that particular job, or in some cases, you have to actually be certified one way or another to perform that job. So you can't just throw a switch, I don't think. It's a big challenge, I think, they've got.
You might have a huge number of folks out with buckets and mops clean, you know, washing the dust off of parked 737 Maxes.
Yeah. Oh, this article, the Reuters article that we'll have a link to in the show notes, also mentions something that we've mentioned before, but didn't have any real information about, which is how long is it going to take Boeing, or will it take Boeing, to deliver that backlog of parked aircraft? And in this article, they say that the process of delivering all those jets will take at least a year. That's just amazing. But all right. So before Max Trescott departed us to go fly his Cirrus airplanes, he gave us an item from USA Today, ugly sweater time. Alaska Airlines gives priority boarding to people in holiday gear. Well, December 20th this year, 2019, is National Ugly Christmas Sweater Day. Now, sometimes it's called National Ugly Holiday Sweater Day, and sometimes I've seen it called just simply National Ugly Sweater Day. So whichever, you know, it's best for you, it's December 20th. It's always the third Friday of December. Now, in any event, Alaska Airlines has a promotion, and I guess it doesn't necessarily have to be ugly, but passengers who wear a holiday sweater on December 20th will be allowed to board early. So it's kind of a clever promotional item, I think.
Does anybody actually have an ugly holiday sweater? I mean, I don't have one, you know.
You know, in fact, yesterday I was at an event and I ran across somebody who had a truly ugly holiday sweater. Oh, man, this thing was kind of hideous. And I think they were a little embarrassed about it. Maybe their spouse made them put it on for the event. I don't know. But I told him that, you know what, December 20th is National Ugly Sweater Day. And he felt, you know, somewhat relieved, and I think vindicated that maybe he was just out there a little bit early.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is not out of character for Alaska Airlines. They also allow early boarding if you are wearing a Seahawks number 3 Russell Wilson jersey on a day that the Seahawks are playing.
Oh, perfect. You know, so I love this kind of stuff because, you know, any business, but airlines try to think up promotional things that are fun, you know, bring some value to the airline, because you don't just do it because, you know, you want people to feel good necessarily. So things like this, I think, are pretty creative and pretty clever. And, yeah, Alaska's doing a good job with it, I think. Again, we're speaking with Dave Graves from SkyVector. That, of course, is skyvector.com. Dave, talk to us a little bit about flight planning. A lot of our audience are pilots and are very familiar with this. But when it comes to flight planning, particularly for, I guess, general aviation and business aviation, are there lots of choices, different methods, different approaches to flight planning?
I'm glad you asked, because this is obviously a subject I'm very keen on. To plan a flight, you need to know sort of the route, and sometimes that's an iterative process, and you discover routes and you run the flight plan calculations and you decide, that's not going to work, let me try something else. But, you know, once you have established the route of flight, then you take your aircraft performance characteristics and the predicted winds aloft and atmospheric conditions, and you run pretty simple math. I think you'd call it junior high school math, maybe algebra 1 or 2. And you come up with some math that tells you your fuel, time, distance per point in your flight plan, and total them all up, and you've got your flight plan. There are a lot of techniques that that you know you can use to get more accuracy. For example, let's say you fly a long direct flight from Denver to Seattle with no waypoints in between. You don't want to just compute the winds at Denver and assume those are going to hold steady for the whole duration of your flight. Mm. And so you subsegment all of your segments. And so we use a maximum segment distance of 20 nautical miles. So if you have any direct segment longer than 20 nautical miles, we'll add points, you know, evenly into that long segment, so that no single subsegment is greater than 20 nautical miles. And then we'll reinterpolate the winds at each one of those points and redo all of that math. We don't show you the details of all of these calculations in your nav log. We just show you the sum for the points you picked. But we internally, we do pick up a lot more points. That same approach we do at a 3 nautical mile interval for climbing and descending, because we expect that wind conditions change more dramatically as you climb through layers than they would, you know, cruising at altitude.
Is any of this aircraft specific? I mean, I'm thinking launch pad. When you're doing your flight planning, is there a difference between that process if you're going to be in a Pipistrel versus flying your Focke-Wulf?
Oh, very much so. And in fact, Dave's cutting himself short, because I use this product a lot. And what you do is you build in your you get to build an account. Oh, by the way, David's offering a special to our listeners. They can start a free account at SkyVector, just like everybody else. No, you build a profile of your aircraft, which is pretty simple, and it makes doing the what ifs really interesting, because you can, you know, pick your destination, pick your waypoints, and just start plugging in. I want to fly at this altitude because I've already told it how fast I gain altitude and how much I burn fuel when I'm climbing versus how much fuel I'm burning when I'm descending. And it gives me a really quick rough estimate. If you do this, this is how much fuel you'll burn and this is how much time aloft you'll be, as opposed to if I change, you know, how fast I want to fly or how high I want to fly, it'll readjust all of that for me dynamically and lets me do some what-if planning.
What about choices for flight planning service providers? Are there different kind of classes of service providers?
There definitely are. So the type of flight planner that you'll find at SkyVector or at AOPA's online flight planner or in most EFB apps are pretty simple. And what makes them simple is really the aircraft model. I think we all do the same thing with respects to speed and winds, and, you know, computing the wind triangles for every point. There's nothing to discriminate there. But when you talk about the aircraft model, especially in a jet fuel burning aircraft, which can, you know, have its weight changed by more than 50% in a flight, it's a much more complicated set of tables. And so what you'll end up with is tables of these performance numbers, whereas SkyVector simply uses a point meaning you tell us your altitude and your speed and your fuel burn at that altitude and speed. You expand this into multidimensional tables. And so you'll have tables for all your different gross weights, whether you're, you know, at max gross and then, you know, with a whole bunch of points all the way down to your empty fuel weight. You'll have different tables for temperature, and you'll have different tables for different altitudes. And so it very quickly becomes, you know, a four or five dimensional problem, which is easy for computers to think of, but it kind of gets hard for people to think of how that all works. And so what you'll find is, and so that's the aircraft model. Then the other discriminatory thing that really discriminates the big boys from the little boys is that whether you do your optimized routing. So it's pretty easy to optimize your vertical profile. You simply run in the flight plan at a whole bunch of different altitudes, and one of them is going to be better than all the rest. That's simple. When you're trying to do that in a three-dimensional space, so your lateral decisions with your vertical decisions, with winds and maybe some airspace restrictions, like you don't want to overfly a restricted airspace, or if you're operating internationally, you don't want to overfly certain countries, then it becomes a much more complicated problem, and it becomes a real optimization problem. And so you've got a tier of flight planners, and I'm going to use Rockwell Collins's Airink Direct as my example of the top tier. I've worked a lot with these guys. I do all their mapping. So full disclosure, they are a client of mine for a lot of our consulting work. But their flight planner will optimize in what they call five trajectories, meaning they're going to optimize laterally, vertically, your cruise speed, as well as the fifth dimension that they're sort of setting as their discriminating factor is for time delays. So, for example, if you're crossing the Atlantic and you know that at 8 a.m., there's going to be a bunch of airplanes arriving at Heathrow, you can decide, okay, is it better to speed up and beat the rush, or should we just slow down so we don't have to burn a bunch of fuel in a holding pattern? And it helps you make those kinds of decisions as well.
Rob, if we go back to the dawn of the aviation era, and when you were learning how to fly, how did you learn how your flight planning skills? Was it something that your flight instructor helped you with? And when you were giving flight instruction to others, do you talk about flight planning as well, or do pilots really learn their skills in other ways?
In the dawn of people learning to fly,
I wasn't going to. It just came out.
Explain how we use string in a sand table, Rob. Tell them how you did that.
No, actually, it's funny. As we've been listening to Dave talk, I was thinking back to the days when we had paper charts. I mean, for navigation, we had a VFR, visual flight rules chart that showed all the things on the ground that you might see, and you had to figure out, well, you just draw a line from here to there, and that's the route you'd fly, except it didn't account for the wind. So you'd have to figure that out either in your head or with a little what do we call an E6B there? A WYSIWYG or something, I think. Whiz wheel. And it was just basically a circular slide rule, which, of course, people are saying, circular? What is a slide rule? They don't even know what that is anyway. Yeah. But it was a lot. And again, it wasn't just the work. It was the fact that it was much less precise than it is now. And that made a big deal. And when Dave was talking about the planning charts for fuel burns at altitude and whatever, those things were so vague. You'd say, well, we're going to burn about, you know, I don't know, 20 gallons an hour or so, maybe if the temperature is this at that altitude. And so rough guess, we're going to need so many gallons of fuel plus some extra. And yeah, that's pretty close. And I mean, but now it is so precise, it's absolutely frightening.
And what does that precision get you? Does that get you reduced fuel burn or time, or, you know, what's the advantage,
The advantage always in an airplane is that if you don't need
all the fuel that you're carrying, you're just carrying extra weight. And that weight could be translated into perhaps more people or more cargo, or that perhaps you can fly further. So there are a lot of variables there. But again, in the old days, you just did the calculation with a pencil and you'd add a fudge factor in there to say, well, I better add about 15% just because my math might not be very good. And that usually meant that didn't mean you were wasting. Well, actually, let me rephrase that, because you are really wasting fuel, because it costs fuel to carry fuel,
right,
because it's extra weight. So anything you can do to reduce the operating weight of the airplane helps you climb higher, especially in turbine airplanes. I mean, it was a big deal to us. And but again, so there, you know, again, and if you follow the flight planning systems now, they're just so close on the fuel burn, provided the weather actually turns out to be what the assumptions were when you made the calculations, which sometimes they're just not, and there's nothing in any flight plan machine can do about that.
David, did you create this software just as a way to solve a problem for yourself, or did you have a vision of creating something that many, many pilots would be using?
In the beginning, it was for fun. I did it for myself. It started as a very simple web app that wasn't even a map component in what I'm talking about. But I just wanted something that would do the nav log for me, because I was a young pilot. And so I wanted to pull in the winds from the National Weather Service and do all the headwind, tailwind, crosswind component math for me. And then so I could just give it a route and it would look up the points that I typed in and spit out the time and fuel and distance for the total. And so that's where it began. And then I went down this rabbit hole of trying to piece it together with the graphical user interface. We launched SkyVector. Originally, it was just a map. So it was the first thing we launched was simply I had gotten the JavaScript working to the where I could piece together a bunch of tiles and make a draggable map. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. I'm gonna put this up there. And I shared it with some friends, and it grew quickly. And so I quickly followed on then with some pretty rudimentary flight planning that didn't do any wins yet. I was never satisfied with the first solution I had made for myself, primarily because I was using like text wheel winds, the same wind product that that you use as a private pilot, I suppose. And the way that the larger systems work is they use the NSEP GFS or the ECMWF. These are models of climate prediction, of weather prediction. These are what produce those hurricane tracks that were in the news earlier this year. The ECMWF is sometimes referred to by the news media as the European model. GFS is referred to as the American model. And they're both very good, and they're both getting better all the time. For example, the NSEP GFS is much, much better than it was just a few years ago with Hurricane Sandy, when it famously missed the prediction that the ECMWF made. And so, for example, the product they put out now is at a resolution of a 1/4 of a degree for the whole world. And at that time, back then, it was at 1 degree, 1 point per degree. So it's gotten a lot more data points. They're rendering it a lot higher fidelity. The data intake that how they initialize the model, that's grown tremendously. They're using automated reports from airlines that have a sophisticated FMS that can report time, temps and winds aloft in real time. They're looking at satellite imageries and using, smart machine vision algorithms to watch clouds move from space to estimate wind speeds. It's gotten really tremendously sophisticated. And all that boils down to this file that I download every 6 hours that contains winds for the whole world at about 24 altitudes and in 3-hour increments, starting from now, when the file was initialized, to about 2 weeks from now. And so any time in that window, I can give you a wind point interpolated in four dimensions. And it's remarkably accurate, especially the closer we are to now. So, you can do a long range planning. Hey, I'm going to fly in 3 or 4 days. You'll get a very rough, is it going to be a headwind or tailwind? And as it gets closer to that flight, you're going to get a lot more accurate. Now, the things that make the winds unpredictable are things like storms moving through, frontal systems moving through. You know, they know, for example, that the winds are going to shift when this front passes. Now, whether that happens a half hour before your flight or a half hour after your flight, that's a tougher call to make, and that could dramatically affect your particular flight.
Well, it sounds to me like you know more about what's going into the creation of this data than just simply this, you know, accepting it as input and just, you know, using it without necessarily knowing anything about, you know, where it comes from or how it comes about. So it almost sounds like, did you get yourself halfway to becoming a meteorologist just as a result of, you know, having to do this?
Not for the winds, but I've been trying to get there for a turbulence prediction that I'm never going to get there. I just don't have the education and training to run my own turbulence model as much as I would love to. The good news is I did recently get access to the WAFS's distribution system, and they've got a global turbulence product that looks really good. It's the product you see on aviationweather.gov. When you go to the WAFS maps. So I'll hopefully get that up on SkyVector once I, you know, work out all the data pipeline issues for that. But I remember years ago there was an AMS meeting, the American Meteorological Society meeting, and they have a meeting every year, but it travels. But when it was in Seattle, I attended, and it was drinking from a fire hose. In many of these sessions, I could barely decode acronyms while I was listening to these presentations, but it opened up a world for me. What I learned while out there is a lot more about how the computational models work and how they're initialized. I also learned about other free weather products that nobody knew about. Specifically, that's where I learned about the MRMS weather radar, and MRMS stands for multi-radar, multi-sensor. It's a very advanced model of precipitation that takes all of the available radar sources, whether they are WSR 88Ds, which are the traditional NEXRADs, or whether they are the faster short-range terminal weather radars that are used for things like wind shear detection. And it combines all of those sources and then does really cutting-edge analysis with it to remove noise, you know, take out dust and insects using some sophisticated dual polarization.
Dust and insects?
Techniques. Oh, yeah. So if you look at an uncleaned weather radar, you will see dust and insects on it. And it can get worse on a hot, dry afternoon. It gets very noisy.
Wow.
So they use dual polarization techniques to eliminate that kind of noise, and then they stitch it all together into this three-dimensional weather picture, and that's what we've been using on SkyVector for several years now. And it's beautiful. It's easily the cleanest and fastest and highest resolution radar you'll find on any aviation site.
Now, maybe tell us a little bit about the user interface. What's that like with SkyVector? What are the kind of considerations that are important to you and that you think are important to pilots?
So this is a tough question because I'm not a user interface expert, and I've made choices with regards to the user interface that really did not go over well with the flying public at times. And I've been humbled by a lot of these questions in the past.
Because they were probably really shy, right? You probably had to really draw it out of them.
Oh, yeah. You really got to beg people to tell you what they think sometimes. No, so, you know, we made a big change to our flight planning in 2015 to support filing. And this is when we rolled out our more sophisticated flight planner, which had the weather winds included and had aircraft profiles and all the rest. Before, it was simply a straight line distance. You tell us your cruising speed, we'll tell you the uncorrected time over the earth. We've kept to sort of our basic main focus is that the map should be front and center. And so all of your planning decisions should be done and supported while you're looking at a map. So, for example, you can get to airport data. You can look at approach plates. You can search for fuel prices, all without leaving the map. And that's sort of been, if we have a goal, that's our goal, is to keep you engaged and visually accomplishing your tasks by looking at the map. So all of the various weather products, if you click on the layers link, you'll get a menu of a bunch of things to turn on or off. And we, with very few exceptions, we don't limit how many things you can turn on at a time. It's really up to your, you know, how cluttered you want your map to be and how much RAM can your browser support. We want you to have a good experience on the map. Now, in terms of flight planning, so I always imagined that you would use your mouse to rubber band a flight plan line, and that was, to me, the coolest idea ever. A lot of people had that idea, so I'm not going to
think
I invented it. But, you know, just to be able to drop a waypoint on, you know, a lake or a small town or whatever you wanted to, or a waypoint that's, you know, defined in a database and charted on a map. I that's definitely the way I wanted flight planning to work. Everything else has been sort of less obvious how to do. So we've got a little flight planning form that you enter your departure and your destination. You can edit your route either textually or with the mouse. And then when it goes to the next step to prepare a filing form, okay, we need to collect a whole bunch more information that was kind of irrelevant on that first page. So then we go to a more detailed flight plan form where you enter your pilot and command info and your surveillance data, and you tell ATC what kind of equipment capabilities your aircraft has. And so we have to collect all this other data if you want to proceed to briefing and filing. But for the most part, you know, most of our users, they either may already have a solution for that, or they're content just knowing, okay, 1 hour, 17 gallons, that's good, let's go fly. And then we're fine providing that low level of service for them as well. But if you want to go all the way through, yeah, we do have the screens that'll take you to the end. But it gets a lot less fun because you kind of feel like you're filling out a bank form.
Max, he's underselling one of the great parts of this product, is that if you're using one of the other WingX, ForeFlight, and you're on your iPad, and you're just trying to figure out how to get from here to there, especially like when I was bringing the airplane back from Canada, SkyVector, when you do it on your home PC and you spread it across two screens, and suddenly I can actually see, you know, big chunks of America and start rubber banding myself to figure out where I want to go, and also doing the what ifs about, oh, let me fly around Cincinnati's Class B airspace. How much longer is that going to take me? Okay, I'll just pull the rubber band up here. And it's that ability to see on a large format of your, you know, two monitors in my case, and spread it out, rather than having to stare at a 4-inch iPhone or a 6-inch iPad or a 10-inch iPad. That really helps you. And it's the big doing the what ifs. And now I'm going to throw a softball question to David and say, explain to us about one of the cool features, which is, after I've planned my flight plan, exporting it to one of those other features.
Yeah, so we're not greedy. You know, we're happy to share our traffic with anybody who's got a great product too. So you can create your flight plan on SkyVector and then export it to a number of tablet apps. So we support ForeFlight and WingX and FlyQ. And I'm going to feel bad because I'm going to leave some people out that I don't remember off the top of my tongue. But a lot of apps, and we'll support more if those apps can tell us how to do it. We've gotten a lot of requests to share flight plans to the Flight Plan Go app. They don't seem like they want their users to use us for their flight planning stage and then use their app for the flying stage. So I don't know if we'll be able to do that one. But yeah, we'll share to other tablets. We also will export to a .fpl file that'll load in a G1000 style avionics on an SD card, or a GPX format, which can load into a Dynon style avionics, as well as Avidyne, although I'm not sure we've confirmed that it works there. And then there's also a number of Android tablets or EFB apps that take the GPX format.
And Max, the reason that's so handy is that, like, for my, when I brought my airplane back from Canada, was to have the primary plan, and then to have, and I labeled it primary plan, then to have four or five alternate plans and send them to my flight, my, in my case, WingX, and therefore I knowing that, oh, this isn't going to work. Okay, I've already done plan B. Let me bring that up and load it. And so, you know, rather than having to, it was really helpful,
mm-hmm.
you know, just using it at the low end of flying.
Well, David, do you think that there are other developments on the horizon? Do you think that there's going to be additional capabilities or functionality or anything, either with SkyVector or, you know, other services that are similar?
So, yeah, we just completed sort of the first phase of a big project we did with Flight Service. So if you've been on 1-800-WeatherBrief.com recently, you'll notice that they're showing off a new map. And that new map looks a lot like SkyVector because we did a lot of the work for them. And it was a really fun piece of work to do with them. It's now live, and you can make your flight plans on 1-800-WeatherBrief using their tools. You'll notice there's a couple of things that they got that you don't get on SkyVector. One of them, for example, is the ability to drag a time slider and see all of the METAR balls change colors as you leave the METAR and enter the TAF in time. And that's a really cool feature that they sort of worked with us. Well, they designed it. They said, here's how we want it to work. And we said, great. And we built it. And we really want to bring that feature back to our users as well. In addition, you'll find that a lot of the user interface controls on the Flight Service map are more appropriately sized for mobile screens. And what that means is they're touch-friendly sizes. SkyVector was originally written as a desktop app, and so the checkboxes are mouse-sized, not finger-sized. And so we're going to be refreshing a lot of our screens and user interfaces to be more touch-friendly. So that's sort of the next thing you'll see on SkyVector is a few of the goodies that we developed as a part of this project with Flight Service, plus a more friendly experience for those who sadly are struggling by, you know, on a small screen. I agree. The luxury of flight planning on a 27-inch monitor or larger is really a great thing. And, you know,
David?
Yeah?
Launchpad here. I'd like you to explain to David Vanderhoof and get his attention. There's a tab at the top of SkyVector when you go into it that's drone NOTAMs.
Yep.
Yeah, talk about unmanned aircraft and how all that figures into this.
Yeah, so Flight Service started collecting what they called UASOAs, Unmanned Aerial Systems Operational Areas. And we didn't like that at all, so we call them DROTAMs. but what they are is these are NOTAMs that will appear in your briefing because they are NOTAMs after all. But they're extremely parsable, meaning they're all composed using an authoring tool that lets you define a shape, whether that's a radius or a padded line or a polygon. They're all well defined and well written, which is not what you can say for a lot of NOTAMs. So we put them on the map on a layer as drone NOTAMs. These have grown. So originally the program was, it had two things. It had both non-NOTAMed and NOTAMed UAS operating areas. And so enthusiasts could log on, create a Flight Service account, and then just say, hey, I'm going to be flying my drone here and at this time. And they could define a shape, and they could define a time. There were no real limits put on the user. So we had some users defining 200-mile radius shapes. And there were no time limits either, so they were lasting a year. And we very quickly made a decision that SkyVector would not be accepting and depicting those. We would accept non-NOTAM UASOAs that were small and short, but nothing large or long. And shortly after we made that decision, Flight Service made a similar decision, but that was simply to say, okay, this doesn't work. If you want if you want something on the map, you've got to call in and make a real note amount of it. And that immediately solved the problem, which I don't want to call abuse, but there was a lot of misuse of the UAS operating areas.
Interesting.
But they're still there. They're growing. A lot of what you see there are some high capability systems with, like Scan Eagles or stuff that'll fly up to 4,000 feet. You'll even see UAS operating areas for, you know, customs predator drones and things like that. So there's little drones and big drones on this layer. I wish we had the details in the NOTAM itself. Sadly, there's no real details about the type of aircraft. But this is an important layer. This is going to be a growing and emerging area. And so we want to make sure that unmanned aerial vehicles and manned aerial vehicles get along.
Yes. All right. David, maybe just give us a little insight into how does the subscription model work for people who might be interested in Sky Vector. You don't necessarily have to give prices.
Oh, I'm happy to give prices because they're all zero. Sky Vector is an internet website that works a lot like Google does, meaning, you know, you use it and you look at ads while you do so, and you're welcome.
So is it all of the revenue is from advertising? Well, probably that, plus you provide some services for other companies.
Correct. So I would say it's about 80-20. So about 20% is advertising that you'll see on Sky Vector, and about 80% is other services. And other services involves large projects like the one we did for Flight Service, or ongoing work we do for companies like Collins Aerospace. But also there's a lot of small licensees of our map tiles. And so you'll find that, you know, a lot of companies will have an aviation product that involves a map of some sort. And their choice is really Google Earth or Sky Vector. And we'd like them to choose Sky Vector. So we've got a lot of affordable options for companies to replace a street map with an aeronautical map in their map platform of choice.
Very good.
Sky Vector is worldwide. You can do European and, you know, South African and Australian flight planning on it also.
So the answer is yes, with a couple of asterisks. Yes, we've got worldwide wind data, and we know the locations of most airports worldwide. The quality of our aeronautical data goes down significantly as you leave the United States and then as you leave the developed world again. So we, you know, our data isn't nearly as good as we'd like it to be for the rest of the world. And that includes a lot of things. That includes terrain data. That includes road data. That includes weather data. So we don't get radar for Africa, for example, but we do have radar for the United States. We don't get radar for Europe, which we should be able to get. We just haven't found a cheap enough source. And when I say cheap enough, I mean really, really cheap. We also don't have a filing solution, and we're actually closer to solving this problem than those other ones. So right now we file through Flight Service, and they'll accept a flight plan from just about anywhere in North America. So I'm pretty sure you could say, oh, I'm going to leave the Dominican Republic and fly to the Bahamas, and Flight Service can handle that flight for you. And you can say, oh, I'm going to leave JFK and fly to Frankfurt, and they can handle that flight for you as well, including filing to all the countries you'll overfly along the way. But they won't take you back. They won't take you from Frankfurt back to New York. And they certainly won't take you anywhere, you know, in Africa or Asia. So we're going to work on our worldwide filing, and we're going to try to find cheaper free weather for other areas of the world. So yes, it works. And we have had some users say that they use us quite a lot. Because there's simply no other services available for a lot of the rest of the world. But sadly, it's nowhere near as good as the experience we can give you for the U.S.
So, David, do you think you'll ever go back to your old job?
Well, that old job doesn't exist anymore, so I'm really in uncharted territory. There's something that weird that happens when you become an entrepreneur, and it's almost poison on your resume. I don't know who would hire me if I had to go look for a job.
No.
They see, oh, you work for yourself for 10 years? Oh, I don't want to deal with you.
Well, it sounds like you've created something that you can really be proud of. I think it's probably fairly rewarding for you. How big is the organization?
Oh, it's very small. So we have a small office in downtown Seattle. It's me, another developer, and an admin slash salesperson slash marketing person. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
I would expect it to.
So if you come by our booth at Oshkosh, you may see the whole company there. So
good, good. Well, I'll look forward to tracking you down at Oshkosh. Hopefully I can find you. Rob, is Oshkosh going to be so big that I'm going to have trouble finding the Sky Vector booth?
Oshkosh is so big that if you're at the north end of the airport, you'll have trouble finding the south end.
Okay.
No. So long as you know what building they're going to be in, almost anybody can point you to the right one. Hey, David, do you know what building you're going to be in yet?
We are going to be in Hangar C, and I don't have the booth number off the top of my head, but we have been assigned our booth number.
Well, Max, if you make it to Oshkosh, I'll be certain to walk you over there so you don't get lost.
If. There's no if involved in 2020 when it comes to Oshkosh.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
You're unconvinced.
Yeah. I heard that here.
Yeah. Okay.
Already making plans.
David, you and I have talked about a feature that I asked you for, but what's the number one feature that you haven't done that your customers are asking for?
Reverse the flight plan.
So what does that mean?
It's a good question because I'm not always sure what that means either. It either means I entered it backwards and I made a mistake, please reverse it. Or it means I want to plan a return flight plan. So they want a second flight plan with a later ETD and a return trip.
So do you think Sky Vector will include those kind of things in the future? Or?
Yeah, we will. I just have to figure out
how to do it.
The answer to that question, you know, what do they mean when they say reverse flight plan? And, you know, how do we make both of those use cases easy and obvious?
All right, great. All right, David Graves, thank you so much for coming on the show. People want to learn more. They should go probably to skyvector.com. Anywhere else?
You could just go to Google and search for flight planning. I think we're still number one there. So.
Great. All right. Thanks again. We have an Australian news desk this episode. Now, for those of you who may be new to the show, you may not know that for many, many years, Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren produced the Oz desk, the Australia desk that we ran pretty much every episode. And the guys got together down under, and they produced a little something for you all, and here they are.
Dateline, December 15th, 2019.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to this strange little segment from a long time ago called, what was it called again? Oh, yes, the Australia Desk. My name is Russell Crowe, and with me is, what's your name? What is your name?
Oh, I'm Tim Finn, mate.
In a long list of New Zealand people that have call Australia home.
Yeah. The Kiwis have said you can take Russell Crowe, but we're keeping split ends, mate.
How are you, mate? It's been 83 episodes since we've done an Australia desk.
God, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yes.
In fact, according to australiadesk.net, where you can go and find out a whole lot of archived, all the Australia desks are sitting there. Well, not quite all. I haven't uploaded all of them just yet, but I'm working my way back through. And
you've been getting around to that for the last 7 years.
Hey, I resemble that remark. But, I've got 141 Australia desks, three extras, and one pre-Oz desk already loaded.
Well, there we go. And I'm sure we'll put this one in at one stage. Anyway. Well, Australian aviation news, what's been going on since, you know, April last year when we last did one of these?
I've been doing some flying.
Well, I haven't. Well, I've been doing a little bit of flying, but, you know, mostly I'm, you know, still driving trains. In fact, I'm driving much bigger trains now, actually. It's a lot more fun.
Oh, yeah. Mate, trains that are much harder to stop and cause a lot more fun as they go past.
Well, you know, the making them go bit's quite easy, I found. The making them stop is, well, you know, and it causes so much paperwork if you don't stop them where they're supposed to be.
Oh, I know. It's always the paperwork.
Yeah, bureaucrats. They're no fun. Anyway, Grant, speaking of bureaucrats, the Australian government has decided that they're going to have a Senate inquiry, in fact, into the parlous state of general aviation here in Australia. And, well, I don't know. I don't know what you think about this, mate, but, you know, we've seen these things before and not really much changed. I hope perhaps something would come out of this.
I really hope something. Well, things will come out of it. It's just, will the government have half what it takes to actually do something about it? We've had inquiries before, and they've come out with very obvious points of things that need to change. And the government goes, oh, quick, bury that. Or, oh, we've implemented these 2 points. Yeah, they were the easy ones. What about the hard ones that actually go to the core and fix the problem? We've seen this again and again. We need to look like we're doing something without actually doing anything. Let's hold an inquiry. So I'm a little cynical. It's all very well to hold an inquiry. Could come up with some great things. Looks like it's got good scope. But it's what happens after that.
This is being pushed by the National Party Senator Susan MacDonald. She's a senator for Queensland, and she's actually gained a bit of a reputation as a champion for general aviation. And this is being pushed from a Regional and Rural Affairs Transport Legislation Committee perspective. So they're looking at it from the standpoint of how is the Civil Aviation Safety Authority's stewardship of general aviation affecting particularly the rural sector. And, of course, here in Australia, Grant, that's a really big thing. I mean, we need a lot of light aircraft. That's really a backbone of transport in areas, in more regional and remote areas. And, you know, we've been banging on about this for a long time. The sector here is, in my view, it's stiflingly overregulated and stiflingly over-bureaucratic, and it's just not serving anybody any good.
Yeah, that's right, mate, because CASA can just say safety. There's absolutely nothing in CASA's charter that says promote aviation, and there's nothing in there that says safety within pricing and cost benefit. So they just go, oh, safety, and no minister is going to do a thing against them because they don't want to be the ones seen to reduce a safety case, despite the fact that CASA hardly ever produces real effective safety cases anyhow. But hey, as I said, let's see what happens.
I guess that's why CASA is known as the Cretins Against Sensible Aviation. And believe me, I've tidied that up a lot.
Oh, yes. That was very polite of you.
Yes. Oh, well, that'll be interesting to see what happens. Now, Grant, your favorite domestic airline, Jetstar, the low-cost offshoot of our national carrier here, our glorious national carrier, Qantas. Jetstar's in a bit of trouble. Their unions are not happy, and there's been a bit of strike action lately. I mean, who do these people think they are, Grant? The railways?
Well, they're certainly learning from your lot, I tell you.
Yes. I say nothing.
Yes. No, about 250 Jetstar ground staff and baggage handlers stopped work on Friday during peak departure and arrival periods in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Cairns and Adelaide. And they went on strike. And then I think it was just, what was it, just yesterday? No, I think it was today that a number of the pilots stopped work for about 4 hours. And, they are out there trying to raise awareness of everything. And, of course, there's a whole lot of passengers who are rather naffed because Jetstar had to cancel more than 40 flights on Saturday.
Yeah, and, of course, a large proportion of the ground staff there are casual employees. Now, casual employment here in Australia means they're not full-time staff. So they can call them in, at a whim and give them as many or as fewer hours as they want. Ground handlers are saying that they're only getting most of them 30 hours a week and they want more hours than that, maybe up around 40 like most full-time jobs and a bit more job security. And, of course, the pilots are looking for a pay rise. So this will be really interesting to see, really. Jetstar is the model that I'm sure Alan Joyce would love to run mainstream Qantas by because it's run under a completely different setup, a completely different cost structure. And, it can be profitable. It's obviously a low-cost carrier model, but it doesn't really look like that Qantas management at this stage is willing to give an inch.
No, they're not. We've seen in the past where Alan Joyce did a double dummy spit and grounded the whole damned airline, claimed that to be a decision made on the spot, but every other indicator was that it was planned in advance. So let's see what happens. It's going to be interesting on the run-up to Christmas. Once again, go on that strike and get your attention.
Now, we'll just wrap up here with a bit of defence news. Now, I tell you what, over the last decade, it's if you were going to be in Australia's Air Force, platform and technology-wise, there's probably never been a better time. There's been so many new platforms that have come on stream here. Of course, I guess most notably the F-35, Grant, of which we're taking delivery of a few more. In fact, a few more arrived in the country this week. I believe our fleet now totals 18, and 13 of those are now in the country.
That's right, mate. We just got another 7 in the other day, and that takes us to 13 in country, and we've got 5 based at Luke Air Force Base, and that's in Arizona, of course, where those aircraft are in the common pool used for the International Training School. We've also got the latest P-8A Poseidon has arrived. I think that's our 12th one. There's rumors we may be getting some more. We'll wait and see. We've got, of course, the Triton unmanned aircraft system. That's going to come on. These two aircraft, the Poseidon and the Triton, will be providing our maritime surveillance and so on. We've also got, of course, the E-7A Wedgetail. That's gone through a number of upgrades since I last got to get on board one back in, 2014. And, of course, the KC-30A tankers. That's all been upgraded as well with Link 16, so it can act as a relay point for communications between various platforms and so on. We've got the Peregrines coming in. They're going to be the Gulfstream jets with the super secret squirrel electronic signals intelligence kind of gear. They'll be coming in the next couple of years. We've just taken on the new Falcon business jets to supplement the VIP squadron. Of course, we've got the PC-21 training aircraft. They're on now. The PC-9's now retired officially. So PC-21's for training. And let's see what else. The C-27J Spartans, they've been bedded in now and flying. Of course, the Super Hornets and Growlers are in place. The C-17s are in place. It's all new platforms that have come on over the last, 10 years?
It would be in the last 10 years. I think the of all of those that you mentioned, probably the Wedgetail is probably the oldest aircraft of those types, although, as you say, it's had a lot of upgrades. Really exciting time. Those F-35s will be going into REF Base Williamtown and going into number 3 Squadron. Interestingly, Grant, just as a supplement to all of those things that you mentioned, at the other end of that spectrum, FA-18 A and B, or Classic Hornets, or Legacy Hornets, as they call them over in the States, the last sortie with two OCU, the Operational Conversion Unit, so the last training sortie of that has gone through. So I guess no more Classic Hornet training here in Australia. You know, I'm most excited about the PC-21s, Grant, because they're based at RAF Base East Sale. There's been a huge upgrade of that base so that all the training can take place over there, and that's not all that far from where I live. So, you know, hopefully we'll see a few more sorties of those things flying around this area. It's all about me, really.
Me.
Well, anyway, we should wrap it up there for this year's Australia Desk. You know, I think we've said that the last couple of years, in fact.
Yeah, the annual Australia Desk. And consider yourself lucky, guys. We deign ourselves worthy of speaking unto thee every year. Something like that.
Well, you know the airplane geeks, Grant. You know we're the ones that made them famous.
Yeah, well, it cost me a kidney, but, gee, it was worth it.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, anyway, folks, it's been another great year of listening. Even though we're not regularly on the show anymore, we still do listen regularly. It's a great show, and compliments to everybody there. And we wish, of course, all Airplane Geeks listeners a happy Christmas, a safe and prosperous 2020. And who knows, Grant, we may even come back in the middle of next year and do one of these.
Well, mate, don't stretch it. I mean, it took us this long to get one out. Two? Wow. Two.
Unbelievable. All right, until next time. Cheers, folks.
Have a good one.
You know that Max Flight, I wonder what his real name is.
I don't know. It's pretty Maxy, isn't it?
Yes. You know.
Although I think he's changing his name because of that damn 737 problem.
Yes. Well, you know, I could use my joke here about a Max Flight.
Oh.
I still got it.
Oh, you'll kill us.
It's always good to hear from those guys.
Boy, they talk funny, don't they?
Yeah, you still having trouble understanding them, Rob?
Yeah, I mean that that's English of some kind, right? Hey, Grant, Steve, nice to hear you guys.
It really was.
It was nice to hear those guys again.
Yes, yes. All right, yeah, thanks for sending that in. We really appreciate it. And, happy holidays to you guys, too, down under.
If we hear them only twice a year, is it semi-annual or biannual?
Semi-annual, I think. I'm not sure. I was always confused by that.
Take it from the insurance industry, it's semi-annual.
There you go. There's the expert. David, have you got something special for us?
Yes and no, but I have a bit of a letter for everybody. So, since my first holiday on the show, I've done a Christmas story. This year, I can't. I'm just not in the holiday spirit. For me personally, this year has been scary dark. I've lost friends, someone I loved, and almost my life. We take so much for granted, friends, family, work, health. Depression is a very sinister place. This year, I didn't go to an air show. I didn't even go to Innovations in Flight Day because I was too embarrassed to go alone, nor did I want to be with my friends and the place I love. You lose perspective. Fear and darkness take over. When I was admitted this summer to the hospital, I was 119 pounds. I could barely stand, had possible cancer, possible liver damage, and severe depression. I just wanted to go to sleep, close my eyes, and not open it again. So 6 months removed, I'm slowly getting better, gaining weight, exercising, working on healing. I have a job now that's helping me heal. I'm learning more about myself and how to take care of myself. So this year, I'm asking your forgiveness for not being a Christmas story and maybe asking a favor. This season, reach out to friends, family, fellow Av geeks, and just say hello. Be a little kinder to strangers, no matter your politics or faith or identity, since we're all neighbors. Aviation has brought us all closer. Aviation family are some of the kindest, caring people in the world. And if you're feeling alone, remember, you're not. Just reach out. I have no doubt our family and friends will be there for you. The most sincere thing I say every week is thanks for listening. Our listeners have given us so much back. Sometimes to me, it feels more than I deserve. I'm lucky to have Rob, Max West, Steve, Grant, Micah, Brad as my co-hosts and friends. And that humble man named Eric, who's been there for me no matter what, and is not only makes me sound good, but makes me feel warmth and always feel better every week. So my wish this year for you all is friendship, blue skies, health, and peace. Thank you for I Am Blessed. This is David, your humble airplane geek historian, signing off. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
David, very good. Good message. Very good message.
Nicely said.
Yes, yes. It is a family here. And here doesn't just mean those of us sitting in front of microphones right now. Just the larger community is, it really does feel like a family. And I think that's important.
You know what? If that's true, then could I talk to somebody about borrowing some money?
Yeah, talk to Cousin Vinny.
Okay. Yeah. No, nicely said, David. And as I said, I won't be here for Christmas, but it's been nice to pop in on a few of the episodes myself in the last few months. Like I said the other day, last time, place looks a little different. Some of the voices are the same. Some of them are new. And some of the really old guys. Gosh, think about the really old guys.
Yeah.
Courtney. What was that guy, Dan's name? Brian, holy smokes. And now we've got some new guys, but you know, is this kind of the point at which I can say what I've been doing?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I was down in Texas, late last week, and I had the coolest Uber ride of my life. I mean, I'm at the airport and I was in San Antonio and I needed to go to a place called Hondo, Texas, to go fly an airplane from the Texas Aircraft Company. One of their airplanes is a new light sport. And the Uber driver, you know, I made the connection and he picks me up and I'm looking at this car and the guy is driving a Porsche. And I thought, wow, I have never in my life had an Uber driver drive that fancy a car. And I look at the driver and I'm going, man, I know this guy from somewhere. I just couldn't figure out where. And as it turns out, you'll never believe who it was.
I can't even imagine.
Santa Claus. It was Santa Claus. There is no doubt in my mind that it was Santa Claus. Because I don't know who else could afford to drive a car like that. No, it was our own launch pad, who met me down there in San Antonio and came along and watched as I try to make a story out of visiting the folks at Texas Aircraft, and we got to have dinner together and hang out. And I don't know, Brad, don't you think that the town we were in, I mean, it's probably it was a interesting place. It was pretty exciting.
The hotel we stayed in was, we'll give props, was a nice hotel, Best Western. Your hotel room looked out over Main Street, and across the aisle, my hotel room looked out over Prairie, not another man-made structure to the horizon.
Yes. It was very open, because actually the Texas Aircraft Company's at the hold at the old Hondo Air Force Base, where they used to train T-37 pilots, I believe. But it's huge, and there was hardly anybody there. And but it was just out in the middle of wide open spaces where I think they used to say things like miles and miles of miles and miles. But the folks at Texas Aircraft were very gracious. They answered all our questions. They even answered some of Brad's questions.
That's true.
So it was a good time. It was a good time.
Well, I want to go back to this Porsche thing. Launch pad, what'd you do, steal the car?
Wow. How the tides turned.
Bada-boom.
I didn't even think you could fit into one of those.
Well, yeah, but you have to move the seat forward for the little guy, for little old guys. But no, I own one. I own a 986, which is the Cayman.
Ah, very nice. Okay.
And we flew down to pick him up because my aircraft had a little bit of a hangar rash and failed a safety inspection. So I was like, oh, let's get in the other vehicle and race down, the other fine German vehicle, and go race down and get him. And transitioning, yeah, that's what I've been doing. I negotiated with a parole officer so that I could have one of the writers of Flying Magazine cross state lines to do a story, as long as I guaranteed to be with him the entire time and then return him, you know,
in the same condition you found him.
Right. And coordinate with his parole board.
So that's how you did it.
Yeah.
It was interesting because when we got back to San Antonio, he only slowed down when we got near the terminal, and I had a jump, but I'm sure that meant something. But but actually, what was really fun is that this light sport aircraft is kind of created as a successor to the famous Cessna 150, 152 that there are probably 40 bazillion of still on the earth. Those were always hard for me to get in and out of, and I'm not even that tall. And I thought, you know what? Let's see how the Uber driver does, because how tall are you? 6'4"?
I'm 6'4", and they've done a really smart thing. The way you'll see it in the flying article, is the doors open 180 degrees on their hinges, so they roll all the way forward to touch the nacelle of the engine.
The cowling,
and they get completely out of your way and allows you to get into the aircraft with unrestricted. It's the easiest aircraft I think I've gotten into other than mine, but mine's got a canopy that you can climb down into. And in fact, I'll say it's easier than mine because you can just walk right up to it.
I think I took a couple of pictures. I'll send them to you, Max, and you can see. It's not even a squeeze.
It
wasn't even that hard to get into this airplane, and it flew really nice. They took a launch pad out for a ride. They actually brought them back as well. I mean, I thought that was really nice.
Yeah, sounds like a good time.
And I'm gonna have a story about it's gonna be an inside baseball story about what it's like to cover. And what Flying Magazine does when it goes down to do an aircraft review. I'm not going to do the aircraft review. I'm going to tell you what it's like inside baseball. And then we're also going to do probably a small profile of their demo pilot. And because their demo pilot's pretty special, and I don't want to ruin it, I'll just tease it. And you may see those in upcoming bits and pieces episodes.
Good. All right. Fantastic. All right, just a couple of quick notes here. I wanted to pass along. John Ostrower, of course, produces The Air Current these days, which is a subscription service that provides really good, really insightful looks at aviation, primarily commercial aviation. But occasionally he produces a story that's open to the public, and he has one out now. It's titled Pilot Procedure Confusion Adds New Complication to Boeing 737 MAX Return. And we'll have a link to that piece in the show notes. But it's very, very interesting. He talks about some of the challenges to getting the airplane back in the sky again. There's a software audit that has to be performed. It hasn't started yet. The 737 MAX hasn't had yet its final certification flight. And interestingly, the Joint Operation Evaluation Board has a review coming up. But that's kind of uncertain because some airline pilots have been evaluating the new systems, and they didn't all get consistent results. So you can read more about that in John's piece. I would invite you to do that. It's also worth plugging it from a standpoint that he's offering $50 off of new annual subscriptions. So you can check that out too, theaircurrent.com. And just a couple of quick listener mails that we received. Andrew sent in a link from the BBC to world's first fully electric commercial flight takes off. And this is about Harbor Air in Vancouver and MagniX. And we had MagniX CEO Roy Gonzarski on what episode? I forget which. Oh, episode 524. But Harbor Air in Vancouver, they provide, they do otter, or beavers, otters, things like that. And they've got an electric version that's flying. So we'll have the link to that in the show notes. And then Patrick sent us an article, Uber Air and NASA launch airspace simulation to enable eVTOL future. Uber Air is working with researchers at NASA's Ames Research Center. And they've developed it's a simulation, I guess. It simulates large-scale eVTOL operations. And this comes from the NASA Air Traffic Management Exploration Urban Air Mobility Team and Uber Elevate. And so we'll have that in the show notes as well. All right. We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, David Graves, the CEO and president of Sky Vector. You can find them at skyvector.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/583. Of course, our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Let's tell people where they can find us online and elsewhere. And Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, I'll tell you in just a minute, but I just want to add one echo to what David said earlier during his letter about thinking about friends. And a good friend of mine passed away a couple of days ago from cancer. And for people in the aviation industry, especially people that are involved with the NBAA, I'm on the Association Safety Committee. They know Pete Combs, who was the voice of the flight plan podcast the association did for many years.
He passed away?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard this.
I hadn't either.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He just died on Thursday afternoon. And he'd been sick since I think they first diagnosed him in late summer. And it kind of, it took its toll. And but of course, Pete was, known as the NBAA guy because he had a really interesting baritone voice. He sounded like a radio guy because Pete was a radio guy.
He was the gold standard
yes.
for what everyone had hoped when we put our heads on our pillows we hope we sounded like.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And you know, that's very well said. Pete was a radio guy. He was a CBS radio news guy. He was also a news guy at an anchor at WSB in Atlanta, which is where he passed away. And, you know, he has his wife, Karen, of course, kept many of us informed of how he was going, how he was doing with a Facebook page she put together called Pete's Journey. And so she broke the news to us on Thursday afternoon, and he'll be missed. He was a good guy. And like I said, a lot of people knew him or knew of him that may not even have known who he was. But, you know, it's a loss to us all. But, you know, I'll tell you, the other point I was going to make, I have no idea what it was now, because as I was talking, I could see it disappearing out my other ear. But you can find me at flyingmag.com for Flying Magazine, where I'm senior editor, also at jetwine.com. And that's on Instagram at Jetwine, and on the net at Jetwine, on Twitter. I don't know if anybody even uses that anymore, but Jetwine there too. And I think that's probably it.
All right. Very good. Very good. David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
Well, over the next 4 days, I probably won't be anything remotely near the internet, because Star Wars has premiered as we are recording this.
Yeah.
And I do not want to be surprised. But otherwise, you can find me on our Slack listener team. And you can join our team by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. And, of course, you can find me on Fridays recording with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
Good. And Launchpad Merzari, how about you?
Well, you can't find me on Facebook right now. I'm still having an argument with those folks about, because they think I'm a fake person.
They kicked you out.
Yeah, they said I was a fake person. But my goal is, A, to try and get back, but I'm going to be much more active on our Slack team, I promise.
Good, good.
I'm also on Twitter at Pilot Launchpad, and that's about where you can find me. And, oh, by the way, the new Top Gun trailer just dropped 3 hours ago. We might put a link to where you can see that in the show notes, because I think that most of our audience, whether you think it's a giant cartoon or the best documentary ever, you're still going to go see it.
Yeah. You have a link to that trailer? Send it along. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at theuavdigest.com. And with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience at paxxpodcast.com. So please join us again. Well, no, not next week. We're going to take next week off for the holidays, but join us after that as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Frequency change approved.
Merry Christmas, and thanks for listening.